Now, before you meet our next guest, let's get a sample of his work. That is called Salute, a piano piece by the composer Webster A. Young. He is now a Rogue Valley resident and has been off and on for decades now, and is the author of a recent memoir called The Luxuries of Unharried Time. Webster A. Young has lived in many places. His book is subtitled A Career in Classical Music from New York to Paris, Aspen, Oregon, and Nice, and From Computers to the Great Recession. This memoir is actually the continuation of an earlier memoir called The Naked Composer. Webster Young is our guest in the studio. Webster, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So I'm curious about the title of the original memoir, The Naked Composer. Is there a story that comes with that?
Well, actually, that is the second title or the second edition, and the title was suggested by a New York editor.
Based on what?
Based on his idea of what would sell.
So there's no story about you standing in the altogether with a conducting an orchestra.
And none at all. It's really just the same book with a different title.
All right. So how old were you when you took up music?
Actually, I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually excelled more at writing and poetry when I was younger than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't exposed much to music because my immediate family wasn't playing instruments and wasn't involved in music.
So what sparked the interest in you? And you apparently got good fairly fast.
Yeah, I was at a boys' camp in upstate New York, and there was a piano in the rec hall. And some of my friends just showed me how to play, and suddenly that's all I wanted to do.
So what was your dream? I mean, once you began to realize that, hey, I can do this, I can make music. I mean, what was the ultimate goal that you began to see down the road? I mean, did you want to become a writer of Broadway plays or a guy performing in bars, or what did you envision for yourself then?
Well, actually, as a teenager, I didn't have much vision.
I would be the only teenager.
Yeah, I became kind of a prodigy on the guitar. And that all changed when I went to UC Berkeley and I met the man who became my mentor in the arts, Kenneth Miller Frantz. And he happened to be my uncle, but he was a brilliant painter who had been part of the San Francisco Renaissance. And it was really meeting him and his family, which involved my aunt, my mother's oldest sister, that changed my life completely, and I took up the violin, and then I knew what I wanted to do, really.
Which was to play violin or to compose?
I wanted to compose, and the reason for that was that I saw how my uncle's painting could change his life and the life of other people through the meaning that it exposed, and I wanted to do the same thing in writing music.
Was there a particular story you wanted to tell or a particular set of feelings you wanted to evoke in people?
Well, his art was all about healing in a Jungian psychological sense. So he was very into depth psychology and had explored childhood memory, which for him was pretty painful. And through that transformed himself. And the man that I knew was a very sort of advanced person who obviously had changed his own life, healed himself through his paintings. And so I think, yes, it was about healing largely, a kind of a psychological healing.
So we've mentioned that this is this memoir is the continuation of the earlier memoir, The Naked Composer, and picks up with a pretty clear breaking point in life, getting dismissed from music school as you're working on a symphony for your master's thesis. What happened?
Well, actually, it was kind of a mistake.
On whose part?
Well, I think on everybody's part. The music conservatories operate in a very different way than universities, and I had come from the university environment to music conservatory. And when I was a student at the university, the composers on the faculty were, we were always in touch. I always had a sense of how I was doing, and I had a faculty advisor. At conservatory, they don't do that sort of thing. It's a much more, the student really is more on their own, even though they have a teacher. You don't, at least then, I didn't have a faculty advisor. So I had no idea what people thought of me as of my work. And when it was really impossible to do anything about it, that's when I was told that I hadn't done the right amount of work. And then I found out later that that perception was a mistake due to my having presented things at admission and then presented the same things that were revised, and a lot of work was done on them, at my jury examination, but they didn't know that. So anyway, it was basically the difference between university and conservatory.
So just not somebody keeping a close enough eye on what you were up to understand fully what it was you were doing.
Yes, I really didn't have any advice, and I was used to that.
Webster A. Young, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his memoir, The Luxuries of Unharried Time. We'll figure out what that title means. We already figured out what the title of The Naked Composer means, which is not much. We'll come back and talk more with Webster and hear some more of his music as we go through the hour. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are visiting with the Ashland-based composer Webster A. Young. I say Webster A. Young to differentiate him from the Webster Young who is well known for jazz performances. This Webster Young is also musical, but a composer of generally classical pieces. We'll hear some more of those as we go through the hour. He's written a memoir about his tour through the world. It's called The Luxuries of Unharried Time, a career in classical music from New York to Paris, Aspen, Oregon, and Nice, and from computers to the Great Recession. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. For the folks who may still be thinking, Webster A. Young, I kind of know that name, maybe. What is the piece you think you're best known for, or the work you think you're best known for?
Well, in Oregon, I think people might know my name from Ballet in the Park, which I was in the very first program as a composer through 7 years of activity. So the first 5 years of Ballet in the Park, I had a total of 9 ballets on the program there, and I was also often on this radio station at the time. So people might know my name from that in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Ballet in the Park was done by, I can't remember the name. Ballet Theater of Oregon?
That was called the State Ballet of Oregon. Mm-hmm. Yes, and founded by Eric Hurst.
The process of writing music for ballet, I remember reading from Mozart's letters that he wrote his operas, for example, to fit the vocal capabilities of the singers he had available in the first performance. And I wonder if the writing of music for ballet has a similar process.
It's a little looser than opera. The composer has less control over the final product. But there are strategies the composer can use to make the scenario and the dancing and the music come together. But it is very much a team effort. So I think the composer has a little less control in ballet.
All right, let's come back to what we were talking about, which is the starting point of the book. This memoir picks up where an earlier one called The Naked Composer left off, which is you getting dismissed from music conservatory for what you see as a misunderstanding. But at the time, you're working on a symphony for your master's thesis. One door closes, another one opens, and it looks like your life got suddenly financially stable.
Yes, that was the same moment in my family's history when the family sold an office building on Madison Avenue in New York that we owned and had inherited. And so, let's see, I don't know how many grandchildren there were, but I was one. I ended up with enough funds to continue a sort of independently poor lifestyle. So that's what I did. And it was really providential because I don't know what would have happened. I was holding student loans and my academic career over
And how big a span was that between dismissal from conservatory to getting this this inheritance from your grandparents?
About 3 weeks.
Wow. So 3 weeks of panic followed by, oh.
Actually, the news of the inheritance came before my dismissal.
Really?
So, but it hadn't materialized.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that was a bit of a stroke of luck. So you didn't really have to think about, oh, my God, am I going to have to, like, wait tables or something?
Yeah.
So was the symphony performed at last, the one you were working on, when dismissed from conservatory?
Yes, it was. As soon as I knew about it, my reaction was very, you might say, capitalistic. I said, well, all right, then I'll make a partnership with an orchestra to perform the symphony and see if I can't even make a little money out of it, even though that's very hard to do. So I found an orchestra in New Jersey and made a contract with them, which was basically a break-even proposition for two performances of the symphony. And I found the conductor, and the conductor eventually became quite well known. He was the conductor of New York City Opera for years and Santa Fe Opera before that. And that's all in the book. So, yes, it was performed in New Jersey, and it was quite a labor because the symphony was huge. It really was almost an hour long. The first movement was as long as some full symphonies are. And I finished the symphony in Ashland and also in Aspen, Colorado, partly written in Paris, too. And the first performance was a really mixed bag.
Mixed bag in the sense of quality or?
Quality, yes. Uh-huh. So the performance was lurched from the sublime to disaster.
Based on the quality of the performance or based on the quality of what you'd composed?
I think I had put a few mistakes in there in terms of orchestration. But it was really the preparation and the difficulty of the piece, less rehearsal than was needed. And so parts of it came out really well, and parts I was sitting there cringing in my seat.
Webster Young is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a classical composer, and he's written a memoir called The Luxuries of Unharried Time. What does that title mean?
Well, it's a poetic reference to time before the Great Recession, mm-hmm. Which for me was not totally, an easy time. I'm sure it wasn't for many people. But I lost my house at that time, and my life changed quite a lot because of the advent of the Great Recession. And so this is really, it's an interesting place to end the book. This book with the consequences of the Great Recession in my life, and there's a hint of what is to come, but that's what the title refers to, even though my life was not unharried as as a composer before the Great Recession. But in a way, it is a look back at times that were under different influences, and to me there's a poetic resonance to that title, because if I had to say what is the only totally unharried time in life, I might say it's listening to music.
Mm-hmm. How different do you find the moods? I mean, I understand that the symphony ended up as Opus 12 on your list. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've gotten to well over 100 by now?
Yes, 160.
160, okay. So as you look across the list of your works, I mean, can you, aside from the fact that they're listed in chronological order, it seems like that they must be vastly different in mood based on what was happening in your life at the time.
They didn't really get to a new approach. That because I'm a neoclassicist, because of my style, I'm not experimenting all the time. I'm actually trying to realize an ideal or a striving for a certain kind of perfection. But at the towards the end of the book, it tells about how I went into the tango. I started going to Argentinian tango milongas, and I did learn the dance, but I enjoyed the music more than the dance. And so I didn't dance much, but I would go and listen to the tango. And the music, to me, is just amazing. I think tango is the most beautiful and sophisticated popular music outside of classical music, to me.
What is the time signature that tango is written in?
Well, tango, the tango that you imagine when you think of the tango is always a 4-4 beat with a strong first beat. So it's often 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3. But then that's called the marching or part of the tango. That is interspersed with very romantic flourishes that are less clear in tempo.
Webster Young is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Webster A. Young, so I can differentiate the classical composer from the jazz musician. He's the author of a memoir called The Luxuries of Unharried Time, a career in classical music from New York to Paris, Aspen, Oregon, and Nice. And we've been talking about the fact that he does live in the Ashland area now. The subtitle is From Computers to the Great Recession. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like to visit. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking for a while and not hearing any music. So the Lament from Orpheus is a piece that you wrote. And I want to bring this up so folks can get a sense of the kinds of material you write. Tell us a bit about who's singing there and the context in which we're hearing this. This is the story, the famous Greek story of Orpheus.
Yes, it is. And there's a lot about Orpheus in the book. In fact, Orpheus is one of the themes of the book, an underlying theme. So the myth is given in full in the book and also my new ending for the myth. That young singer you heard was at the time in his early 30s. His name was Tony Kim. This was in New York, preparation for a concert near Lincoln Center. And he was just a wonderful tenor. And I wasn't accepting tenors to sing my music who spoke English with a heavy accent, because then you have to coach them to pronounce the English. But his voice was so good, I said, well, I'll just do the extra work. And so he premiered three sections of my opera, Orpheus. And at that concert was the granddaughter of Arturo Toscanini and some very interesting people of the New York opera world.
You write in the book about your attraction to melody. I mean, and a casual observer who doesn't understand music as well as you do would think that that's the main point of composition. I mean, if not melody, then what?
Yes, and in fact, that's how the avant-garde of classical music kind of made itself irrelevant, is it departed from things that are pretty obvious, like melody. But melody can be the subject of a lot of exploration. So even though it's a obvious and most important feature of music, it still can provide a lot of material for someone seeking to perhaps innovate. But yes, you're right. It is obvious. It is the main subject of music in a way.
I mean, there are some composers who are considered melodists above all else. Is that right?
Yes. I would say that music history has identified certain composers, especially George Frideric Handel. He decided as a young man that he wanted to be a great melodist and then carried it out. And there are other composers that are you would point to as very conscious melodists, Maurice Ravel. Ravel just slaved over his melodies. He said that he just worked over every couple of notes in every melody. You know, he just worked very hard. And the work shows that he's among modern composers. He's written some very beautiful melodies.
Talk about the process of music coming to you. Is it the kind of thing where you hear it in your head all the time and need to get it on paper at some point? Or,
well, actually, it's a little easier to understand than you would think, because any time you start hearing music in your mind, you know, some song you heard on the radio, that's what I would call your musical imagination. And what's providing you with that memory of some music you heard is what I would call your unconscious mind, just pushing that into your memory, into your imagination. So really, everybody has a musical imagination. And every artist has to use their imagination. So every painter has to envision what he's trying to put on the canvas, what he or she is trying to put on the canvas. And so the imagination is the territory, and the unconscious mind is sort of the provider of material. That doesn't, the interesting thing is that that doesn't mean you're getting good material.
Learned that a few times in your work, have you?
I don't take every suggestion of my musical imagination. I reject plenty of things that pop into my mind, as I'm sure some people do when they hear some piece they don't want to be hearing over and over again in their mind.
The earworm.
Yeah.
Webster A. Young, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a composer of classical music, the author of a memoir called The Luxuries of Unharried Time. I'm curious about the process of composing, though. I mean, when you actually sit down and begin to commit things to paper or commit things to an instrument, and I noticed that you prefer not to compose on a piano, which I found really interesting. What's the reason?
Well, it's easier to be objective away from the piano. Although I actually use everything available, so I will be at the piano. A lot of times improvisation is a very good thing for working on music. And other times I would sketch music into a book where it's not permanent. You know, I'm not writing down the finished piece. I'm making notes and sort of like playing with mathematical formulas or something. And then at other times I have to kind of imagine, is this really good or not? You know, I mean, I think most composers use a number of methods.
But there's something about the piano itself and the sound of it that I read in the book that you don't like. Did you prefer a clavichord or a harpsichord, for example?
Yeah, at first I had a bit of a phobia about the piano, which was not only my own. I knew other composers who had that. And the reason is that the piano has three strings playing the same note per note, and it very, very subtly, that aspect of doubling notes could have a subtle effect on your, as a composer, on your perception of harmony. Now, that was a bit of a phobia, really. I got over that pretty quickly and was very happy to be able to write well for the piano. But at first, I did use a clavichord, which has one string per note.
Does modern technology help you a lot? I mean, I would have to believe that if you talk about improvisation as being important, there's so much available to record what you do, and in fact, even record the notation as you play it, that it probably helps a lot of the process. You go, "Ooh, I love that section. I want to just grab this part here on the computer and paste it wherever it needs to go," that sort of thing.
Yeah, those things are available. I don't know how efficient they are, though, strangely. Like, I can write down with my hand, for example, some things that you could take much more time to write down using a notation program. And so actually the efficiency of a lot of these things is a little illusory. They can be a great help, but they can also be a drag too. I mean, I can do many things faster without these things.
We'll talk more about technology and artistry and composing with Webster A. Young. He is the author of a memoir about his life writing classical music, composing classical music, The Luxuries of Unharried Time. We will take a little time out and come back and rejoin Webster Young in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Ashland-based composer Webster A. Young. I keep calling him Webster A. Young because there is a Webster Young who is a jazz musician as well. And I want to make sure we differentiate the two. This Webster Young composes classical music and writes about the process in his memoir, The Luxuries of Unharried Time, a career in classical music from New York to Paris, Aspen, Oregon, and Nice. And from computers to the Great Recession. You're welcome to join our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned not having a lot of musical people in your birth family, but it sounds like you've got some friends from your youth who stayed with music. Jeff Baxter was one that certainly rose to the top.
Yeah, and I did hobnob with some of the stars as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Skunk Baxter, famous for his work with both Steely Dan and the Doobie Brothers. You still stay in touch with him?
Not really. I sometimes hear news through the grapevine, but mm-hmm. we really just went different ways at about age 18 or so.
So given your interest in music and you know, when you're a young person, you don't necessarily think first about classical. Were there times you thought about pop music or jazz or other genres other than classical?
No, my conversion was very complete to serious music, but I did envy the economics of popular music.
Yeah, it was quite impressive in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But you mentioned the fact that when you first had your first symphony, actually played by an orchestra in New Jersey, that you even tried to make a little money on it, which was hard to do. Has that been? How have you managed to? We talked about the fact that you got an inheritance at some point, but I assume you've had to bring in a few dollars over the years with what you've been doing in classical music. Has that been a tricky thing to do?
Yes, it is. It is a tricky thing to do, and I should mention that in the course of the book, I lose everything twice. So it is also a story of losing and coming back, this book, although that's not the main point of the book. But, the music world is now tough for almost anybody who hasn't already made it. And it is kind of a mixed bag of getting by with different things. And that's true for me. I publish online. And by the way, if you're looking for me online, put in Webster Young Composer. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to find me online, is Webster Young Composer. So I publish sheet music online. I have recordings at cdbaby.com. All of these things produce kind of little tiny royalties, you know, and other things. And then,
so if not revenue streams, revenue trickles anyway.
Yeah, and then there's the whole world of grants, patrons, and I've been fortunate to have found a patron in 2010. He's not a huge patron, you know, he doesn't have billions of dollars or millions of dollars, but he is very interested in serious music and has helped me over the last 7 years now.
Who is that?
That's Robert Crawford of the REC Music Foundation. And his interest is in neoclassical composers and alternative repertoire for opera.
Let's talk about your work in opera. I mean, this is the work that you consider the highest level of art in music?
I do. Not everyone agrees. The symphony is considered the Parnassus of of musical composition if you're going to be strict about it. But opera is either number one or number two. And for me, for many years, there was no question in my mind that opera was just the absolute greatest thing ever.
Mm-hmm. What is it that really gives you the greatest joy out of the process?
I think that it is the arias and the dramatic moments that the arias embody. Really, there's nothing like it in both theater and music, where the idea of the hero, which is just the simple dramatic idea that the hero represents your interest as the audience, where you get a moment where the hero expresses, and if it's the tenor, then, you know, where the tenor expresses himself. And one of the most famous moments in opera is the signature aria of Luciano Pavarotti, Nessun Dorma, where he's on the doorstep of fate, mm-hmm. you know, waiting to know, you know, is he going to die or is he going to get married tomorrow? Mm-hmm. You know, but in very poetic language and great music, he is the hero at that moment on the doorstep. And you, in the opera house, you just really identify with that. You're up there on the stage with him, you know. And those moments are unparalleled, I think, in all of music.
And even people who don't know opera well can remember, for example, the opening ceremonies at the Torino Olympics, where he sang Nessun Dorma, you know, and everybody can probably come up with that melody. Da, da, da,
da, da, da, yes, da, exactly.
And on we go. So rather than doing my bad impressions of Puccini and Turandot, why don't we hear some more of your music? And I wanted to play a bit from Under the Greenwood Tree, from As You Like It. Was As You Like It done as an opera?
It was, yes, it is an opera, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, and of course from a Shakespeare text. So let's hear Under the Greenwood Tree from As You Like It. So who's singing there, and how old is this piece, and did you actually start As You Like It before you came to Ashland, which is the home to the Shakespeare Festival?
Actually, As You Like It is one of the main themes of this book as well, and really the Forest of Arden is one of the main themes of the book. That's the setting for most of Shakespeare's play. And as I kept coming back to Ashland and coming back to the atmosphere of the Shakespeare Festival, I realized that Ashland really is a Forest of Arden. And I think the Forest of Arden has a literary cachet in the literary world. It's a byword for a place to retreat to, a place in the woods where you retreat and recover from the politics of the world, the problems you encounter. And so I realized I'm kind of living out the return to the Forest of Arden by coming to Ashland all the time.
I should point out to the audience that you'll be giving a book chat tomorrow night at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, so the Ashland connection complete there. Your Ashland experience is one that can't be captured today by a lot of people. You came in the days, I think, in the 70s, when the Shakespeare Festival had just gone to year-round, or more or less year-round performances, with the opening of the Bulmer Theater, the indoor theater, before the town essentially gentrified and got a lot more expensive for artistic types to live in. So you had quite the artistic ramble, it sounds like, for a few years in your own Forest of Arden.
Yes. When I first came here, the south side of Mountain Avenue was just big fields. I think the town has developed very tastefully. I have to say, I think what growth there has been has not changed the town in a way that I would perceive as negative. I think the growth has been very well done, and I think the artistic nature of the town has continued in a wonderful sort of way. And so there's a lot about it that I like just as much now as I did then. I will say I was very fortunate to hear some of the greatest Shakespeare, to see some of the greatest Shakespeare performances I've ever seen anywhere during that era when I first arrived. And I saw Barry Craft as Benedict in Much Ado. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's ever been a Benedict that good anywhere. And I've been other places. I've been to the Royal Shakespeare in England, Shakespeare in New York, and I have never heard a Benedict like that. And so the As You Like It here that I attended, also I have never seen a production that good again. So I was very fortunate to have that happen while I was here.
Where was your As It Like It opera performed, As You Like It opera?
It's never been done in full. I tried to get it to New York City Opera. I actually told Paul Kellogg, the director, about it. But the opera ended up in the hands of their composer in residence, who is totally different than me and got axed. A lot of arias have been performed and in concert, and online you can find 10 arias from my As You Like It.
You've also put up some works from other authors as well, other famous works, including taking on Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. And in fact, let's see if we can hear a clip from that. This is It's Best for You, written by Webster A. Young for Hemingway's text from The Sun Also Rises.
It's best for you.
How much of a trick to put Hemingway to music, if any?
Yeah. Well, actually, it was interesting to arrive at Hemingway as a subject. I wanted something that concerned Americans in Europe, because I wanted an opera in English that was set in Europe that would still be very realistic. And the best stories I could find that had American expatriates were the Hemingway short stories and some of his novels. And I'm not, let's say, 100% a Hemingway fanatic, but I do see the virtues of his writing and the structure of his stories that, to me, lent itself to opera. And so The Sun Also Rises was kind of where I arrived after researching what in Hemingway might make a good opera.
So you mentioned an American living in Europe. You have lived in both Paris and Nice, and I assume a couple of other places as well. So the attitude about the arts, I mean, it used to be that there was much greater state support for the arts than there ever was in America. Has that situation continued, or has that gone away with time?
In Germany, it continues. England has its debates, but it's a very different system with royal patronage. France continues very strongly, but their support is greatest for film, the French. So it basically continues. I mean, sometimes it has its rocky moments. In France, it has recently, but.
And so in this country, it's really a good idea to find a patron, as you have, as you mentioned, with Robert Crawford, who is not a gigantic, as you mentioned, patron, but certainly willing to support some work. So are you still working on material now, and what lies ahead for you? What do you still – what's the mountain you still want to climb?
Well, a couple of years ago, I began to realize after, 160 works that I had done everything I really wanted to do, but then I thought, well, maybe I should try new forms. So I have been I've tried a form that is unfamiliar to me, which is the concerto. Of course, I studied concerto form, but I never wrote a concerto. So now I have three concertos I've written, and I'm very happy to do that. And then I started experimenting with a new form that hasn't really been explored, and that's what I'm doing right now. It's basically a way of stacking many, many musical themes in a row in a way that has the energy of a tight standard musical form.
All right, so concertos and this other genre you're talking about. Webster Young will be at Bloomsbury Books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in Ashland. His memoir is called The Luxuries of Unharried Time. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It was a pleasure.
All right, take it easy.